Welcome to the Citizens for Health radio show on Building Fortunes Radio with your hosts Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Make sure you check us out by clicking on the Citizens for Health radio show link on buildingfortunesradio.com. That's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Citizens for Health provides over 100,000 supporters with consumer news, action alerts, and opportunities to take action. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. The Citizens for Health Education Foundation offers tools to inform the public of health issues and educate and influence policymakers. Jim Turner is here to spread the word about some of the most interesting topics that can affect your world, from the dangers of mislabeled or dangerous products to the questions and concerns of vaccines. You'll want to listen to Jim as he speaks on behalf of Citizens for Health. And now, on to our show with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Take it away, Peter.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. For many of you that might be unfamiliar with my voice, you might be a first-time listener, or maybe there's a new symptom of the coronavirus that might be happening. We're not really sure. However, we are here every Friday at noon with a great friend of ours. His name is always Jim Turner. Jim Turner is an attorney over in Washington, D.C. And, Jim, I hear a little bit of background noise. I don't know if that's me or you. But Jim Turner is a gentleman who is an attorney over in Washington, D.C. He's been associated with Citizens for Health. Citizens.org is the website, but Citizens for Health has been around since 1993. I recommend that you listen to any of our previous radio shows to learn a little bit more about the background of Citizens for Health. He started from almost the very beginning. He is originally one of the original Ralph Nader Raiders, which means he's been fighting for consumers and a whole bunch of other things for a really long time. He wrote a book called The Chemical Feast. He is a wealth of knowledge in addition to a whole bunch of other things. And one of the blessings, I'm going to say, of having the coronavirus happen is that Jim Turner is now traveling less, so which means he's available for us more on Fridays at noon. Because sometimes when he's traveling, he just doesn't have time because he might be in the air or in the car or somewhere else. But we get a chance to take advantage of Jim Turner, and we are developing all the new things that are – or talking about all the new things that are developing as a result of what's happening with this coronavirus thing as it's happening live. So sometimes we raise some questions. Sometimes we'll give you some answers, but we always love to have Jim Turner here on Building Fortunes Radio. So, Jim, thanks for being here.
Yeah, great to be here. Any answers we give are they're always tentative and always one of many. So we are not fonts of insights. we try to provoke a discussion. So
that's true.
What are we going to talk about, Peter?
Today, you know, this coronavirus thing just isn't going away. So I think you know, it's really affected a lot of industries or people negatively. It has affected some industries positively. But for the most part, a lot of us are trying to figure out the challenges. So, you know, most of the time, if your business is booming, you don't have to even, you know, you don't need any help except for how to manage the growth. It's the ones where things are struggling a little bit or where things are being imposed on us. So I guess to kind of kick it off is down here in Florida, they are telling us that there's a lot more cases of the coronavirus. And now locally, even my own town, I'm hearing things posted that wearing masks are being mandated. So I'd be breaking the law if I don't wear my mask and I go outside, which is really getting kind of crazy that politicians, if you will, are going to be able to tell me as an individual what I'm supposed to be able to do when I step outside my own house if I want to live in this area. And, you know, if the science was settled, let's playfully use that, if the science was settled and we found out that masks are 100% safe and effective, we'll use those words from the vaccine guys, then maybe I might not have an issue with this. But I do have some issues with the idea of some politician who's running from a local congressperson or local councilman telling me what I'm going to be able to do when I walk outside my door if I want to walk down the street, go to a store, or maybe even wander among a beach. So let's kick it off with maybe some of those issues. So I kind of gave you a whole grab bag to jump in on.
Sure. The tricky question when policymakers are operating is which way do you lean given an absence of information? I mean, we don't political involvement is for things that aren't obvious. You don't have to have a law telling people not to eat cyanide. You do have to have a law that it's killing somebody if you put cyanide in their food. But there are things like wearing the mask, which are debated. What is the way the society decides what to do about something when we don't know the answer? So let's just take what you just said. If you say, well, when the science is settled, maybe if it was settled that the mask was obviously very protective and didn't cause problems and so forth, if that was all settled and it was known that it was obviously a good thing, then that might not be an issue. Then I would just wear it. But the problem is the day that you know that is not the day that it was first true. So the very first day it was true, whatever you're going to find out over time is true. And the question is, what do you do between the time that it's possible that something might be true and the time that you know for a fact that it's true? And let's just, to make the issue more binding, let's just say there's an issue on day one that the mask may be harmful or it may be helpful. And at day 200, we know that it's helpful. We've demonstrated to your satisfaction that it's helpful. That between day one and day 100 or day 200, it was just as safe and effective during those days as it was the day we knew for a fact that it was safe and effective. And the question is, what should we do for that 200 days? On the other hand, if we know in 200 days that it was clearly unsafe and ineffective, what could we have done during that 200 days when it was there? Well, the fact is, the way I look at it and the way the law looks at it, is that most of the time you leave that issue up to the individual. You provide the information that says, here are the arguments for why it's safe and effective, and here are the arguments why it's dangerous and harmful, and why it's dangerous and doesn't work. And those arguments are presented, and then each individual decides, well, on the basis of what I know about life and reality and this information, I'm going to wear a mask or I'm not going to wear a mask. And that's worked out and then people do it, and everybody respects everybody's choices. But there are two things that happen that make that a difficult process to use. One is that at a certain point, it becomes a question, am I hurting myself or am I hurting other people? And the more that it's possible, the more that the possible risk, even if a small risk, is going to affect a lot of people, the more likely there is to be an intervention by some kind of authority. On the other hand, people can step in and politicize an issue like this, and they can say we, for political reasons, we think you should wear a mask, or for political reasons, you shouldn't wear a mask. If you do it for political reasons, then the chances of being right are pretty slim. Because I'll give you an example that I learned very early on when I was working. When I first started working on FDA issues, and I was still working with the Nader Group. And the issue was birth control pills. And this is in 1969, and the issue was there was no warning on the birth control pill packages told consumers there could be dangers from birth control pills, and we wanted one. We thought that patients should be given information, and it's now called the patient package insert. There was no such thing in 1969, and the first one that was ever adopted was the birth control pill patient package insert. And the issue was that we wrote in what we thought should be in every package of pills, that birth control pills. It was about 900 words long and had a bunch of stuff in it. The FDA ultimately mandated a statement to go along with birth control pills that had about 140 words in it. And what was interesting about their statement, one of the things it said was that 2 out of 100 women will suffer blood clotting damage requiring hospitalization. Now, my concern that I raised there was that if you say 2 people will be harmed and you don't give any guidance as to what that is, the people who choose not to use the birth control pill will be ones who are risk averse. and the people who choose to use them will be ones that are risk accepting. But there's no correlation between people being risk averse and being at risk, or being risk accepting and being not at risk. So you'll have people, so out of the 100 people, you'll have a bunch of them saying, I'm not going to take the birth control pill, and it may not even include the two people that are going to be harmed. The problem with the masks is masks may or may not help people, and each individual needs to decide that for themselves as much as possible. But if we get a political movement going where we say, if you wear a mask, you represent one political faction, and if you don't wear a mask, you represent another political faction, then nobody's free to make their own individual decision. So either way, mandating it or making it a sign of a political position makes it less likely that the people it will work for are going to use it. And now when you start looking at the data, personally, I think I wear a mask when I go outside in Washington. It's not required. But I would say right now 90% of the people on the street are wearing masks. Generally speaking, the authorities, health-wise and police state-wise, you know, the police powers-wise, are comfortable with that. The difficulty is that wearing masks is at least in large part done to keep you from spreading the disease. It's not done to protect you from stuff coming in. It's done to protect other people. That seems to be the major consensus about the mask. So that when people don't wear the mask, they're saying, we don't think that we're sick. We don't think that we don't think we have the virus. We don't think we're going to make you sick. And we don't think it's airborne or whatever. And they might be right. At a certain point, the authorities are going to step in, however, because if a lot of people aren't wearing masks and the virus is going up, then you got a problem on your hands. And that's when people step in. And by the way, I think any politician stepping in and arguing politically that the mask should be worn or not be worn is a huge mistake on the politician side. The mandates that are being given out by somebody who's been an elected authority and is relying on or spreading medical advice that they've been given. If they're doing it politically, I think it's the wrong thing to do, no matter what they're saying. Wear the mask or don't wear the mask, politically bad. On the other hand, in concert with that, we want everybody to be able to make the choice for as long as possible, as much as possible, and see what the response back is. Now, there's more to say about that at this point, but why don't I stop and get your questions? Because I left a few questions open. Let's see which ones you're interested in.
Well, you sure did. For number one, for those people that are listening in, I learned something again new today, that you were involved in the inserts that happen in drugs or types of things like that. We always take for granted that's the way it always was. Just like, for instance, those safety tops on maybe beverages or bottles of vitamins, or that, you know, that seal that you have to kind of peel off with your face or your, you know, whatever kind of device you probably use. You know, those things were actually implemented by people taking action. So, and I didn't realize the very first one was with birth control. So thanks for the insight.
Yep, there you go. That's some information for you.
And also the point is that people do make a big, you know, things that aren't being done today be affected by people doing things today. So for those people in the future, we'll be taking those things for granted 20 years from now, the stuff that may happen today. Here's my biggest issue. I think any time the government says you have to, we get everybody, you know, things are mandatory because otherwise you're doing whatever. They really set up the whole bunch of things that create the news issues that we see today. Some lady saying to some guy, you should be wearing your mask, and then him, you know, flipping her off or worse. Or some girl saying to a lady, you should be wearing your mask. You should be. I think the government, that's all self-inflicted. If the government would say to me and put up a compelling case, listen, it's highly recommended, you'd be doing people a favor, blah, 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 if you can. If they gave me the inkling of a choice, I would be okay. When they tell me I have to, that's where I really get a little bit resentful. because not for nothing, but I look at these political buffoons. Many of them are, not all of them. Many of them are. But I look at these political buffoons that are doing things for whatever reason. They might be doing things to get either reelected or worse. And I say, now you're going to tell me what I have to do? I'm not going to bow down to that. So I think it's a sales issue or a positioning issue. And I don't know if they know that or they do that or they just don't care because of that far removed or that power freaky friendly. So I'll let you comment on that.
Well, I think that the key point here is that what you're saying is, in my view, what you're saying is exactly what a democracy is supposed to be doing, because the principle is that the collective decisions of each individual will ultimately give us the right answer. That works, and it's recognized in the law, and that's the way we're supposed to be doing things. It works pretty much almost all the time. It's the almost that makes the problem, because sometimes there are things that the government has to step in and mandate. The one that's used most frequently is the draft. Now, we don't have a draft now, but we do require every kid to sign up for the draft. We don't have a draft, but every kid has to register. That's a mandate. You must register. And it's the determination of the political process in our society that we should have the ability to call up every kid to go into the military when we need them. And we're not going to wait around and pass the laws then. It's a mandate. You have to sign up. Now, it used to be before that you signed up and then you had to go to your draft board and you had to explain to them, they would send you a notice and say, now you have to go report to, Fort so-and-so on so-and-so date. You just get it in the mail. And then you'd have to go into the draft board and say, well, I can't go for these reasons. And then you tell your reasons. I liked my reason when I went to the draft board and said, I can't go. I'm sorry. I don't like what you're telling me. I can't go. And my reason was because I've already signed up and I'm a naval cadet or a naval midshipman in ROTC, and I'm going to be in the Navy and I'm going to serve. I was so pleased with the draft board's response to that because they didn't have a comeback that they could make. So there was a case where I was actually doing something that they were trying to mandate, but I did it voluntarily. In our culture, law-wise, we have a set of rules for when something that's mandated can be mandated. So, and they're there. They're very simple. The first question is, does what they're mandating interfere with the fundamental human rights? I mean, that's a legal statement. That's not a political or rhetorical statement. It's a legal statement. So things like life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and some others are fundamental human rights. If it is a fundamental human right, then the burden of proof is on the government. And the government has to prove, one, that this thing that is, in fact, that this thing that they're saying has to be interdicted, whatever it is, in this case, wearing a mask, they have to prove that wearing a mask is, in fact, addressing a problem, which is a major problem that requires giving up some rights. They have to prove that. The next thing they have to prove is that the thing they're telling you to do, wear a mask, will in fact help solve the problem that is considered to be such a big problem that some human rights need to be given up. And then thirdly, they have to prove that it's the least intrusive way of giving you the opportunity of protecting you from whatever the problem is that they think is big. They have to prove all three of those things, the government does. I'm pretty sure that I would not be able to win a case against the government on mandating masks. I'm not sure that the government would win a case on mandating a vaccine. And this is a very tricky issue. So, Peter, you want to ask yourself the question, if you had the choice between the government mandating a vaccine or mandating a mask, which you would choose?
Well, if I had to make the choice, I would make the choice about a mask as opposed to a vaccine. And we're leading up. We're leading up to another question about if they can mandate a mask, will they be able to mandate a vaccine? So I'm glad you're leading up into this. So go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I'm saying is that kind of issues are there. And it used to be when those kinds of issues came up, let's say back in Elizabethan England, just pick an arbitrary time, What you did is if you were on one side of the issue, you went and you found all your friends and you got somebody to fund you and you put together a team of people, you know, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 people with guns, and you went down to throw out the government. I mean, that was the way we solved those problems in those days. And then, you know, the people that were in the government, you know, got guns and repelled you. What we've tried to do, what our objective with our American system, which is dedicated, you hear the words all the time, you know, and we operate a society based on laws, is we've tried to reduce all of that political and violent fighting down to a legal structure, which is a very interesting structure. I mean, it's fascinating to watch it work because it's not the kind of thing that you can announce today what it's going to do next week. And so when they come up with, say, mandating a mask, your point, you made a great point. You said, I would have it would be a very credible to me if they presented an argument why I should wear a mask. And if they persuaded me, I would wear a mask. And I will bet you that if they present a credible argument, the vast number of people will, in fact, wear a mask. Then what happens is if there's a group of people left who won't wear a mask, what happens is when the law gets passed that says you have to wear a mask, it has more credibility because it was not the first thing they jumped on. It was last. It was last in the line or last before the next thing. And this is a whole process that should be going on. And unfortunately, you know, buffoons or not, the political process has got itself organized so that everything's a fight. And, you know, there are reasons for that because we've misunderstood what it is that we're trying to do with politics. What we're trying to do with politics is solve problems. And politics is not the idea of being the one in charge of all of the machinery of government. It's how to solve problems. And getting in charge of the machinery of government is one of the tools that you have for solving problems. But the most important thing for solving problems in a society is empowering the individuals to make informed choices. And if they do, just systematically, those choices will emerge with a good decision over time. And that over time is a problem because, you know, maybe in the pandemic, we don't have that much time. I don't know exactly what's going on here. I mean, people ask me, what do you think of the coronavirus situation? And the number one thing I can tell you is we don't know much about what's happening. And we should really step up to the plate and say, we don't really know very much. We're operating in the dark. We don't know what this is all about. And then start looking at how do we learn more as individuals and as a society. And anyway, I'm getting a little rambling there, but if I figure out what I didn't touch on that you would like me to touch on in that answer.
Nope, it's perfect answers. But the question is going to be, is if we're fighting some resistance here about the masks, what kind of resistance are we going to face when it comes to the vaccine? Part of the reason why I would resist wearing a mask is, number one, I'm not so sold on the fact that it works. Now, if I go into a doctor's office or a hospital and I want to try to reduce my exposure and everybody else's exposure, I'll put on a mask. It just makes sense. You know, if I'm going to be playing around in the dirt and maybe in the farm, and I got to play with the cow manure in the fields, I'm probably going to wear some gloves. So that just kind of makes common sense. In regard to vaccines, if I think masks are somewhat questionable, if you said, well, what's your questionable level on vaccines? I would be like way high. I don't have any faith. Zero. Zero, like you said, not even 1%, like 0% faith, and that this is a slight exaggeration, that they're going to get the vaccine right. And for them to mandate me, roll up your sleeves, that's going to be a really tough one to consciously deal with. So I think reactions are going to be escalated. So I'll let you comment on that.
Well, I think that the corona vaccine issue is going to be very, very intense and difficult. First of all, Dr. Fauci has been working for 30 years to come up with a vaccine on AIDS and has failed. As nearly as I can tell, and I've got a couple of people who are trying to find out whether this is accurate, but it does not appear that there's ever been an RNA vaccine that's worked. There are some theoretical reasons why a vaccine won't work in the coronavirus world. Now, the vaccine guys will jump up and say, "Oh, that's crazy! You're sowing fear and so forth." But I did hear Dr. Fauci say the other day that maybe we're going to need 5 or 6 vaccines. I understand that this thing changes its DNA. It goes through a genetic change every 7 to 10 days. One of the biggest we can't make a vaccine for the common cold, and it's very clear that there's a big problem in the flu. The main reasons appear to be that there are so many different strains that you don't know how to match the vaccine to the strain. So the theory of how a vaccine works is great on paper. Lots of things are great on paper. If you can match this vaccine to this viral strain, you will get protection. Okay, I can see that. I understand that. Then there's, as they say, many a slip twixt the spoon and the lip. And when you come out at the other end and start jabbing something in people's arms, I got involved in 1976 in that issue of the swine flu at that point. And I'd been working on an issue of how vaccines are regulated. They were regulated extremely poorly in 1970. And working very hard and diligently, we managed to Congress and the Justice Department and the HHS and so forth, all working together, move the vaccine regulating authority from the NIH, where the primary job was to find new vaccines, didn't worry too much about whether they were safe and effective or not, just find new vaccines. And then they were, after the investigations were done and so forth, all that work was moved to the FDA, and they set up a new Bureau of Biologics. It's still problematic because there are two different laws, the Food and Drug Law and then the Public Health Service Act. And the vaccine manufacturers want to be regulated outside the Food and Drug Law. The food and drug argument is that they are actually drugs and should be regulated under the Food and Drug Law. And that's fought back and forth in Congress and so forth, even to this day. But what I'm saying is that that we are unclear on a whole set of issues about how we translate the science about viruses into the actual product that is ultimately utilized. So, for example, in the vaccine, the debate in public is almost always about the active viral component of the vaccine. Very little actual attention is paid on the talk shows and so forth to the fact that the vaccines carry with them, the product vaccine carries with them, not only the viral, the antiviral activity component, but also various other things that extend the safe, keep them clean during the time that they're on the pipeline going from the manufacturing plant to the doctor's office or the school or whatever. They're kept with certain kinds of preservatives. There are certain kinds of adjuvants. There's a cell line that they're grown in that carries with it. Some are grown in monkeys and some are grown in human cells. And there are people who are pro. They say human cells are bad and monkey cells are good. And there are other people saying monkey cells are good and human cells are bad, or their human cells are bad and monkey cells are good. That's all debated inside the science. But when you walk up to the doctor's office, first of all, you don't even know what the substrate, that's what it's called, what the cell level it's grown in. You don't even know what that is unless you take the time to look into it. When I had my kids vaccinated way back in 19, was back in that at that period, we had a doctor who was very, very up on this, and we actually had vaccines. We found them, found a measles vaccine in Canada that was grown in a different substrate because he felt that the potential risk of the then prominent measles vaccine, just the one-shot vaccine, was enough to say, let's get one that's safer. Now, there's a whole big argument about safe and not safe, but there's a sub-argument, which is safer or less safe. The fact is you can go out and get safer vaccines than other vaccines, but that's, hardly anybody knows that. So I'm saying I'm very, very cautious about the coronavirus vaccine. I believe they're going to have a very, very hard time finding one. And when they do find a bunch, if they do find a bunch, they're going to have a very hard time matching them to the people that need them. It's a tough, tough scientific problem. And then you have some other sides of the issue that are very, very troubling matters. right now, we have very strange kinds of results from people getting the actual virus. I mean, some people get really sick and some people don't. And it's not clear why that's the case. Right now, they're saying children don't get sick. So maybe we don't have to worry about children so much. But I'm worried if you don't worry about children, maybe they won't get sick in the sense of having having symptoms. But what makes it? How do we know that they aren't harmed in some way that makes them more vulnerable to the next time the vaccine, the virus comes? And these are things we just don't know. So what I'm saying is, personally for me, anything I can do at the moment that's not a terrible burden, like wearing a mask, I'm going to wear the mask for the moment because I've seen the evidence that says it did not be work or might not work and might be harmful. The harmful side seems a little bit stretched. I don't see the mask as being harmful. It might be do nothing. In terms of not working, it appears to me that it depends on what kind of mask you have. Some work better than others, and so you work your way through that. When it comes to the vaccine, I'm very nervous, particularly if we're going to have a situation in which they're going to say you can't go out of your house unless you're vaccinated. I mean, these are wrong decisions because you can't move a society, any society, into the right direction by ordering it. The people in the society have to embrace the decisions and work in congruence together around the decisions that are made. And what we need is a process that allows us to sort through the whole question of what we're going to do about this pandemic. And by the way, it's pretty clear to me that it's going to keep coming. I don't think this is not something that it's gone eventually. It's been being warned about for a couple of decades now. That is, pandemics have been being warned about. There's a book, books called like Plague and so forth, that look at the science of virology and say there's a problem here that we have to deal with. The biggest policy failure I've seen all the way through from 1969 to now, and I think it existed before that because we were looking at what had gone on before, but mainly probably from the Second World War because we used all this stuff in the Second World War and then just transferred it over to the civilian population without thinking through the fact that we had taken a lot more risks during the war because the risk of something not working or causing harm was less than losing the war. So, but those things got transferred over into being used in the civilian population. And what I'm concerned about is we have not actually addressed a whole bunch of issues that are important. Why is it that when we vaccinate a population, that only some of them get protection? In the Disney outbreak of measles, 40% of the people, this was back in 2015, 40% of the people who got the disease at Disneyland had been vaccinated. That's a very troubling reality. We need to get this under control. And the greatest policy failure that has been made is we've put almost 100% of our resources into developing something like a vaccine, rather than putting some resources into how do we strengthen the individual to resist the viruses themselves. And we still don't know why a bunch of people out here get the virus and don't get sick, and another bunch of people get the virus and do get sick. Why? What is it about the people who don't get sick that mean they don't get sick? Those are things that really should be part of the public policy in order to sort through if, when, and how we're going to have a vaccine. And also, having a vaccine and being having it be voluntary is a much more likely to come up with the right answer than making it mandatory. If you do it as a voluntary vaccine, then people that want to do it will take it, and we can start measuring how effective it is. If you have people who voluntarily take the vaccine and then 40% of them still get sick, that tells you something about the vaccine that you have to address. That's not the kind of thing that happens when you mandate it. When you mandate it, then the ability to even know that they're know the difference between people vaccinated and not vaccinated is compromised significantly. So all these are very, very important issues that need to be sorted out before we start going around mandating vaccines for the coronavirus.
Great points. What's really frustrating or to somebody like me that's trying to apply common sense to this. If we don't know what vaccine is going to work, why are we investing hundreds of millions of dollars in federal government money buying vaccines? Like, why have we already made that decision and we're buying all these vaccines?
I understand that on the coronavirus, we're not buying vaccines because we don't have any vaccines. And the first question is, it may be that there is never a coronavirus vaccine. I mean, there are all kinds of very bright guys out there and women out there working really, really hard to come up with a way that you can take things that you see in the laboratory and turn them into something you can inject into families across the country. And these are the best and the brightest that have done so many things that have caused problems for our society in the last 50, 60 years. I mean, these are the guys that have brought us, you know, the Facebook that listens in on everything. And they've created a whole security problem with hacking and, you know, people losing their credit cards. I mean, the kind of thinking that we're trying to, the process, the thought process that we're using to address the coronavirus vaccine issue is the same kind that we use to address how Bank America manages its credit cards. And what you have is millions of credit cards getting hacked over and over and over. And we're assuming that you can do a risk-free, zero-risk vaccine using that same kind of thought. And in fact, it's very possible that we're going to have a huge fallout from a vaccine that's not been thought through carefully and applied properly. It's a possibility. So what I'm arguing is, while looking for the vaccine, looking for the virus and looking for the vaccine, why not take 10%, 20% of the money that we're approaching this issue with, and look at how to strengthen the individual's ability to resist the virus. Obviously, there are millions of people out there who are getting the virus and not getting sick. Why? Why is that? We should know that. That's as important to know as how a vaccine can protect the others. So all I'm saying is that we need to really think this thing through and have a good, coherent policy. And unfortunately, the people on the firing line have to make decisions today. They don't have time to sit around and think about this stuff.
So, and maybe there is, but why isn't there that test group of people where the government says, listen, we're going to try to boost up the immune system of this city, and we're going to send everybody, whether it's this city, this population, or this group, we're going to send everybody some of these whatever, supplements, herbal products, homeopathy stuff. Here's your package for the month. And I know we'll have a whole group of people saying, oh, the government's going to be poisoning you because you're taking this vitamin C, and they embedded everything else in this vitamin C. But the reality is, why don't they try? Have they ever tried anything like that?
Never tried, and we need to make that be the kind of a part of the process that we use. There will be a lot of resistance to that. There are a lot of people who are out there making these arguments about science is the answer. But when you say, well, okay, let's put science to focus on these kinds of questions, they say, no, that's pseudoscience. You can't do that. And the interesting thing is, science is a process. It's not an outcome. Science is a process. If you use the process, you'll come up with good answers. But the process can only be applied in ways that the people currently in control of science want to give the outcomes that they want to have. They don't want to look at things like homeopathy or vitamin C and so forth. I don't know why they don't, because it's really quite challenging and very interesting, but they don't. And the result of that is that things that have little inklings of potential are just shunted aside. And in the meantime, you know, the public is out there suffering. They will not have the opportunity to evaluate these alternatives. And the next thing that's going to happen is there's going to be a mandate to take a vaccine, because they're going to say, well, the science said vaccine is the right thing. But that's only in a science that did not look at everything. If you only look at vaccines, then you're going to come up with the answer as vaccines are the right answer.
So I guess the perplexing part is, maybe there's not a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. who's paid enough money to go push in that general direction, and maybe the lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industries just pay a lot more money. So they have a lot more political influence.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry makes so much money that it has a lot of money to spend on that. All these alternatives don't make very much money because they don't have 500,000% markups. So they don't have the money to battle against something that has that much money. Unfortunately, the political world right now is tied to money. And that's a very serious problem in the sense that lots and lots of issues that should be being looked at are pushed aside because the lobbyists won't let them come onto the floor. And that's the name of our politics.
There we go. Okay,
hey,
perfect. Well, we're into
Boris. We're almost 15 minutes over at this point.
We can go for this for sure. There's a lot of other topics, but we'll save those for future weeks. Jim Turner, for those people listening in, you just heard from a great attorney. His name is Jim Turner. He runs Citizens for Health. The website is called citizens.org, CITIZENS.org. That's citizens.org. Sign up for the newsletter. Check out the previous radio shows that we've done. Send them to your friends or other people of influence. And, this way you can make a difference in your world. So, Jim, thanks for being here. I really super duper appreciate it. Lots of great insight. And one of these days, I'd like to rekindle when we have time and we're not talking about something like the coronavirus, how that package inserts thing happened. Because I find that very fascinating.
Okay,
I'm sure that was
that.
A fascinating story. Okay, good. All right,
we'll catch
you next time.
We can talk about that. Sure. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim.
Bye.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Citizens for Health radio show, brought to you by Citizens for Health on buildingfortunesradio.com with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Thanks for listening. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. Go to www.citizens.org to learn more and always listen in to Building Fortunes Radio, where our special host, Jim Turner, shares crucial information about many of the most important issues that affect your world. Citizens for Health provides over 100,000 supporters with consumer news, action alerts, and opportunities to take action. So listen in, get involved, and help spread the word. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website to hear more Citizens for Health segments with Jim Turner and Peter Mingle. And read about what's new on www.citizens.org. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. Jim Turner, Peter, and I want to say thanks for listening and ask you to go spread the word. Tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.